Welcome to Sundial. I'm Carlos Frias. Let's take it back a minute. Back to 1984. The playwright Orrin Squire suggests if you want to know something about what was going on in America, in Miami, there's one person you could look to. The king of pop, Michael Jackson. He just dropped the most theatrical music video in the short history of music videos, Thriller. Orrin takes us back to that America, to his place in it, as a kid growing up near Opa-locka. It's the spine of his new play, Defacing Michael Jackson. It's playing at the Colony Theater in Miami Beach. Orrin paints a picture of one street in a black South Florida neighborhood. Four kids who all love MJ. A new boy moves onto the block, a white kid, the first white kid most of them had ever met in person. The block starts to change. Their friendship starts to change. And Michael starts to change. Just like America, Miami was changing. Orrin's written for the stage and for TV. You might have seen his work on the CBS show Evil or This Is Us on NBC. Now he's telling a story about hero worship, about identity, and about Miami. Welcome, Orrin.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I appreciate you coming out here because I know that you're in promotion, right, for Evil and for the play, right?
Yes, we're wrapping up the fourth season of Evil as far as scripts are concerned, and then they'll film, and that should be out late summer, beginning of the fall. So we're in the midst of cracking the last script.
Very nice. Well, I know I want to talk about this play to begin with, Defacing Michael Jackson. Because like I love the fact that it's these kids in Opa-locka, which is not an area that gets the marquee necessarily a lot of the time. So I want to test a little of your Miami street cred.
Okay.
Can you sing any part of the Opa-locka Hialeah flea market theme song?
Oh my God!
Come on.
I grew up with this. And I'm mixing it now in my mind with the early Poetry Tropical song. So,
let's see what you got.
The harmony. I'm like, Opa-locka flea market, but I'm singing Poetry Tropical. Chicken on the grill. You'll never taste it. Chicken this good. Opa-locka flea market. That's what I'm mixing it with. But we would hear that on the radio along with the Miami Herald jingle 1-800-441-0444. Boom. And then the paper landing on the front steps of your house. But those are like the early 80s, late 80s jingles. I just can't. Opa-locka, the Pollo Tropical thing is in my head.
I love that.
Miami Herald.
I feel like we just screwed off the top of your head and all this music came
jingles.
Coming out. You know, what did you think, how do you feel that Opa-locka affected the storytelling in this play?
Well, it's based upon a childhood ritual exercise. And so we were taught that childhood rituals are like your personal mythology. You take a little bit of truth and then you build out the mythology of the world. So when I was being taught this by Rogelio Martinez, who just had a play at Miami New Drama, Elion.
Oh, right. The Elion play. Yeah. That was a big deal. Yeah.
And he was teaching this from an exercise that Maria Irene Fornes, famous Latina playwright, created. You find that entry point of something mythical that you can build out from. And then you look for a time that's mythical that matches that, and then a place. And I felt like the Michael Jackson ritual that we did, being the first family that had a VCR on the block and kids coming over, combined with 1984 and Thriller, which is a mythical time, and then Opa-locka, which is this very unusual city. Like I said in the play, it has the largest collection of Moorish architecture in the Western Hemisphere. Its sister city is Baghdad, Iraq. The CIA's airplane runway and airport, I think, is in Opa-locka, that helped with the Bay of Pigs invasion. So Opa-locka has this very interesting history, but a lot of people drive past it and don't check out the architecture, don't know the history of the city, don't know the CIA airport and how Miami is filled with these airports because it's easy for people to transport illegal weapons to other countries. And Opa-locka is sort of a part of that interesting subterfuge as well as open history.
I was going to ask you about your personal history. So you described a little bit about what happens in the play. How much of that was you? Were you the kid on the block with the Thriller tape?
Yes. I mean, it begins with the initial thing that you did that formed community and was ritualistic. And you describe it, and community can be just two or more people. That's all it means. It's not, it can't just be you in a room.
Right.
So it's you and another person who's forming a community. And then the community falls apart at a certain point because it's a childhood ritual. At a certain point, we grow up. Technology improves. People get the new VCR. Prices drop. You don't need to get together to watch something on a VCR. Like my parents, when they were, my dad, I think he was one of the first people who had a television. So people would stand outside and watch TV. But then at a certain point, television prices dropped. And that ritual goes away because everyone sits at home and watches their own TV set.
Plus, so, it's this moment in childhood, right? Which as a kid, it feels like it lasts forever. But exactly. We know looking back that it's just this flicker, right?
Exactly.
Now, I remember when Thriller, the video, dropped. Like, I was out playing street football with my cousin in Hialeah, and my other cousin, his sister, opens the front door, and she's like, the Thriller video's coming on! And literally everybody just dropped what they were doing and raced into the house to watch it. Tell me about what it was like for you to see that video for the first time. Or do you have memories about like what it meant to see that video, to see Michael doing his thing?
It was like being transported into a movie. It was a game changer. I think there's certain Rihanna songs and Beyonce songs that are similar, but I'm older. I imagine if I was 6 years old, hearing Beyonce drop Lemonade or Renaissance, I might have that same feel. But it's one of those things where you can see and feel your brain changing, the synaptic links coming together, thinking nothing will be the same after this moment. And, you know, the OJ trials like that, tabloid stuff was like that, as well as cultural landmarks like Thriller. And feeling like you can turn off the lights and watch a music video because it's like you're in a movie theater. And you can see the short version or you can watch the long version. And he was the first to really do that now is common, the concept album with the visual that Beyonce has done, that Prince has done. He was the first to really spend money to create a world, because it isn't about liking the music, it's about liking the lifestyle, as we've learned from Apple. Apple, you're not buying the technology, you're buying a lifestyle. And Michael Jackson was one of the people that was like, I'm not just gonna give you singing, I'm gonna give you dancing, I'm gonna give you fashion, I'm gonna give you choreography you could do. Now we have TikTok that you can replicate with your friends and practice, and I'm gonna give you a whole visual reference point that you can use when you're dressing, when you're talking, when you're dancing and moving with people. I'm getting you to buy into a lifestyle.
So talk to me about how that rewired your brain as a kid. You growing up in Opa-locka or nearish Opa-locka. I think you grew up near, we would almost call it Carroll City, right?
Well, it was unincorporated Dade.
Unincorporated Dade, right.
So, and then when I was a little kid, they built Joe Robbie Stadium, and we still call it Joe Robbie Stadium, even though its name changes every 5 minutes.
JRS forever,
exactly.
Man.
Exactly. He paid for it. His name should be on it forever.
It's what I'm saying.
Yeah. One of the last true heroes that paid for the stadium they built and used. But, like, it was called Unincorporated Dade. So half of our mail would say Opa-locka, because it came from the Opa-locka post office. Half would say like Miami, and a little bit would say like Carroll City. So there really was a sense of you could be anywhere. It was a no man's land that people sort of forgot about. And so I feel like half the time when people ask me where I was from locally, I would say Opa-locka. The other half I would say Carroll City. But I would never as a child say, I'm from unincorporated Dade, because kids would be like, what is that?
I'm from a census designated area.
Exactly.
And so like your work is... It seems like it's inspired by where those different cultures meet, right? And because obviously, like the play has, the first white kid moves onto their block, right? And I'm curious how that inspired. Was there a moment like that for you that kind of began to change your worldview a little bit?
Yeah, there was a moment when a white family moved in. We briefly met them, and then there was a moment when Latinos started moving in. The area that I'm talking about was a lot of ranch houses bought by black families in the 60s and 70s. And this is back when people would have a full backyard garden and they would grow tomatoes, squash, vegetables, and they would eat from that. That's what my parents did. They had a garden, new variations of like cantaloupe would come out, engineered by University of Florida or what FSU, and you would try out growing cantaloupe or watermelon. And it was a time of discovery and tucked away. It was fortunate that people didn't know about it, because when people know about it, especially something black, they tend to swarm the area and destroy it, or the property values go up. And so it's been tucked away, and then the stadium brought more attention to it than Walmart, and it goes the way that things go when they're appropriated or gentrified. But it did feel like you're scared because you realize you're in this tucked away point that might be discovered. But at the same time, you want to be appreciated, so you want to be discovered.
Right.
You want people to know how great this is, but at the same time, you don't want too many people to know, because they'll all come here and buy up the houses and raise the value.
It's like the next good restaurant that pops up on the block, right? Like, you want to tell people how great it is, but also I want to be able to get in there when I want to.
I was taking an Uber to Fort Lauderdale Airport a few weeks ago, and the Uber driver knew a very fast shortcut using the police route up to the departure gate at the airport. And I said that, this would be great if other people knew. And he said, no, I don't want people. Yes, this is a great shortcut. I do not want to know that people can take the police, you know, route that cuts your driving time. And so, yeah, it's about, if no one knows you're smart and clever, then does it really count? But then if too many people know, you're no longer smart and clever when everyone's doing it.
Right. There's a serial killer mentality in there somewhere. But
yeah.
So tell me about your folks, because if they were growing stuff in their backyard, tell me about them a little bit. Like, what was your life like if you're the kind of kid that grew up eating food from the backyard?
Like, well, by the time I was like a young child, I think they had phased that out because people were in their mid-40s. They started having to work jobs. You're in that yuppie period, mid-80s Miami. The gardens fade. They become smaller. Now you're just growing tomatoes. Then you're growing tomatoes every other year. But we grew tomatoes in the front yard, and we had oranges. We had lime tree. We had key lime on the side. And then near my bedroom window was a very big mango tree. And so we had like sort of a garden-esque feel, the remnants. We can keep a mango tree. We can keep the orange and the key lime tree, and then some tomatoes every once in a while. Then they took the backyard and cemented a huge part of that and built a patio, a covered patio, so that when people came over, they could sit outside. And then we tried growing tomatoes in the pots. So now the tomatoes go from the field to the pots, and then you sort of lose a little bit of momentum as you go on.
It's like a metaphor for Miami, isn't it, right there? Yeah. So tell me about, for a kid growing up in Opa-locka, did you feel like, tell me about how that, was it a place that you mentioned, I think when we were talking earlier, that it was like a place that you had started to plan your escape from. Why is that?
At a certain point, there are people who love to stay home, and then there are people who are anxious and want to see the world after you've gotten a hint of what home is or was.
And who did that for you? Who did it for you there must have been a moment or a series of things that make you think, I can leave Miami-Dade County.
Yeah. Besides TV and film, one of the biggest impact things in my childhood was radio. So I remember 610 WIOD that had Rick and Suds, Randy Rhodes, Chad McKay, Neil Rogers, God, as you say.
Neil, God.
Exactly. Phil Hendry. And there was a certain point, and Larry King came up through Miami radio. And there was a certain moment when you had Randy Rhodes, Neil Rogers, Rick and Suds, Phil Hendry, 4-hour time blocks, the 16 hours of the best radio in the world. And a lot of them were New York centric, or they would talk more about New York. They would talk about the world. And it's just this voice coming through the box while you're driving, having skits, taking calls, being able to tussle with callers. And it just made me want to see the world, these voices coming out of this box, based in Miami, but telling you there's so much more, and sort of loving Miami, but also making fun of the regionalism, the tribalism, some of the things where people only think the world is Miami, and popping that bubble, especially Phil Hendry. Right. He would do these sketches where he'd pretend to be Miami people. And I think one of the sketches that made my dad pull over on the side of the road because we were laughing so hard was a KKK gift shop. And he was promoting this KKK gift shop, and Davie used to be the headquarters of the KKK in South Florida. And irate callers were just calling up and not breaking character. He would, you know, promote his KKK gift shop. Black callers, white callers, locals. He'd be like, would you like, you should stop by. We have a KKK dashiki. And the black caller would be like, why would I buy a KKK dashiki? He's like, we have some lovely hats from African American History Month, these other things that are KKK sponsored. And I feel like you know something satirical because you have a greater sense of humanity in the world, and that people that don't know that's a joke, I don't necessarily want to live with them forever. If you really think someone is creating a KKK gift shop in South Florida and you're making yourself angry, like visibly angry and calling up and yelling, I want to see other people. I want to explore the world where people get that that's a joke, obviously, that's an exaggeration. I want to get a world where he did another sketch where it was a black guy who was just so happy that he was Christian and he wanted to thank white people for slavery. That was another thing that made me pull over to the side of the road. We were laughing so hard. It's a joke.
Yeah.
But white people were calling up saying, thank you. It's about time that people thanked us for bringing you over here. And then the twist was halfway through the sketch, Phil Hendry playing the black guy goes, yes, because you introduced me to Jesus, who is, of course, a black man. And then you saw the calls change in the middle course. They'd be like, thank you for acknowledging us. But Jesus was white. And they'd hang up the phone.
There must have been something about that. You're talking about so much about Phil Hendry here that like that storytelling, that theatrics, the twist, those things, how you could make an audience react, that I can kind of see the dotted line connection to writing theater, which is what you're doing.
Yeah, I'm always looking for the gray area, having the setup, and then at a certain point, how it twists. So you think you're watching a black guy celebrating white people, but he's really celebrating black Jesus. And you see how the audience, both black people shift in their reaction, as well as white people, like, wait a minute, I thought we were going in this direction, but actually this is about this. It's subversive. And I'm always looking for the subversive area in the gray, especially since Miami is a stew of like 40 different hamlets, little principalities, and like all these different races. It was never black and white. In fact, when I went to school in Chicago, it was the first time where race seemed very, very simple. It was black, white, Mexicans in Chicago. That was pretty much it.
Atlanta felt like that for me when I lived there for a while. Like if you were Hispanic, you just fell into the lump, probably Mexican.
Yeah. And in Miami, it always felt like when I went to school, it was black, but then it was Jamaican, it was Haitian, it was black people from up north, black people down here, Bahamians. And we all didn't get along necessarily. It was Haitians, it was Dominican Republic. And then with Latinos, it was never Latino, it was Cubans. It was people from Mexico, it was people from Venezuela, it was people from Argentina. And you could not group them together. They resist being grouped together.
Yep, that's the truth. And so that must have been, listening to the radio, you mentioned your dad. Was that a way for you guys to like bond? Were you close to your dad in that way?
Yeah, we bonded over books on tape. We bonded over a lot of teaching courses where you could listen to them on tape decks, and then radio.
What did your dad? Your dad was obviously clearly in like educating, like in like the development of the mind. You know, what? Tell me about your dad a little bit.
He was an occupational specialist or job counselor at Northwestern High School.
Okay. Go Bulls.
Yeah, go Bulls for like 20, 30 years.
Wow.
And then towards the end of his career, he was at Carroll City High School. But he was a person who became the unofficial dad or father for hundreds or thousands of kids. And when I was growing up, the phone would always be ringing all the time. And after school, I'd pick up the phone, and a lot of times it'd be a voice in the other line saying, is dad in? Is dad home? And it would be a kid from Northwestern, and I would say, just a minute. And I would hand the phone to my dad, and he would have to go meet them or go to jail where they were being held at, or help talk to their lawyer or talk to a judge, find them work, make sure they're stable. He was doing all of that. So he was always educating and trying to give back to the community.
What was it like to share your dad like that?
I was fine with it because people needed a dad. If you're calling someone dad, if you're coming to them for advice, if you're coming to them and inviting them to your wedding, then that makes sense to me. I mean, I'm not someone who, I guess, is protective like that. Like, no, only I can have it. I feel like that exists today. I have a friend whose partner is a teacher in the school system in Miami, and people want to make this guy their dad desperately because there is this huge gap, a lack of father figures. And when you're in school and you see, number one, a male teacher, not that common.
Not that common, yeah.
And then a male teacher who appears to be on par, decent, morally righteous, educated, and a man of color, people just flock to that because it's a need, it's a desire. So it was an honor watching that as a child.
We're talking with
He passed away in 2021, at the start of 2021, after a long convalescence, not from COVID. It was one of the strangest things. It wasn't from COVID. And we found some of his old tapes. We found some of his old letters. And it was some of his students or some of his kids writing from prison saying, "Hey, Dad, could you talk to my lawyer about this? And could you tell them this? Or could you tell my mom to drop the charges? I was just taking the car for a joyride."
Wow.
And this is like a time capsule of all the work he was doing and the community that he was a part of. And we were a part of in some way.
What a role model to have in your life and in your home.
Yeah, Stanley Squire and my mom, Yvonne Squire, who worked at the church, Cosmopolitan Baptist Church, and in her own way was giving back to the community through her Christian service.
We're talking with the writer Oren Squire. His new play is called Defacing Michael Jackson. He's also a TV writer. His current play is playing at the Colony Theater in Miami Beach through April 2nd. We're going to take a little break on Sundial and be back with Oren in a minute. We're back on Sundial. I'm Carlos Frias, and our guest today is the writer Oren Squire. His new play is Defacing Michael Jackson, playing at the Colony Theater in Miami Beach. We're talking about our dads here during the break.
Yes.
I lost mine in 2020, you're talking a little bit about when you also, after losing your dad, how you begin to be part of this club, you know, and seeing how you start to look back at the way people shaped your life and your growing up. And so much of your growing up then affects your own work, your work beyond that. Tell me about that a little bit. So, like, you have this desire to travel and to get out of South Florida and to see more of the bigger world. How did you decide that you wanted to tell those stories and explore those stories through theater?
I think that was my dad's desire, my mom's desire. They always talked about when they retire, they're gonna buy a Winnebago and travel around the country. When they retire, when they get to this point after working most of their lives, and unfortunately, my dad had a stroke a year before retirement. Oh. He never got to buy that Winnebago. And so I started coming home back to Miami, the place I tried to avoid at all costs. Started coming back to help out and to help out around the house. And that was the next 15 years.
Wow.
And rediscovering Miami, being here, whatever I had free moment, it was go back to Miami, help out, get a little bit of money in New York City where I live, go back to Miami. And it was great. And I started writing plays and I traveled for work. So my plays got done in Los Angeles, was done in London a few times, and I got an excuse. I had an excuse to travel. My plays in Toronto, Seattle, I'm going there. And then when he passed in 2021, I remembered he always wanted to travel and he wanted to wait until he retired. And tomorrow is not promised to us.
Yeah.
And in 2021, after going through that period of grief and mourning and my mom renovating the house and being here for work, as well as the opening of the Louis Armstrong musical I wrote, also for Miami New Drama at the Colony, A Wonderful World, it felt like I needed to honor that legacy, to get out there. So a friend, Tatiana Suarez Pico, who I lived with for 5 years when I was in grad school, was in London working on a TV show. My TV shows I work on, The Good Fight, Evil, they're great, but they're based in Brooklyn. There's no fancy travel. So she offered me a room in this apartment in Camden in London, and she could work, I could work, and I got to see London. Then she said, let's go to Paris. And for a moment I got scared, like, oh, travel, but I'm here, comfortable in London, I'm comfortable here. And I had to let go of that. I'm like, why are you scared of going to Paris? People do it every day. Just hop on the train, go to Paris. We went there for 4 days. And then she said, I got to go back for work, but now you're sort of free. Where else do you want to go? I said, well, I want to go to Berlin. So I went to Berlin and I had my script due for The Good Fight. And I was writing my script for The Good Fight in Berlin. I got the corrections on it and I did another pass when I was in Amsterdam. So I was turning my script in the last night I was in Amsterdam. I hit send. I ran outside to a bar and, you know, had some fun, then hopped on the plane back to London. And then she said, you want to go to South Africa? And then I was like, oh, I'm really scared of that. So, yes.
Oh, interesting.
And the second part of her TV show was shooting in Cape Town, South Africa. So I went down to Cape Town spontaneously. I was supposed to fly back to New York. I canceled my ticket and flew down to Cape Town. I was down in Cape Town. We traveled around South Africa, feeling really scared, getting more comfortable, and then coming back up through Barcelona and then Iceland and then San Francisco and Vancouver, Montreal, and a whole bunch of other places that I went to. And then the second time, I was like, I'll visit you again before you leave Cape Town. It was going through visiting a friend who is a Serbian, is a TV writer, but he's also kind of a Serbian folk singer, pop star.
Beautiful.
A black guy who sings Serbian music sticks out.
Yes.
So this guy sort of became a pop star in Serbia, and he was going back to Serbia to record a song, and I said, can I tag along? It's like, maybe this is a story, maybe it's not. He goes to Serbia, we're in Belgrade. People are looking at us because they recognize him. They think I'm his bodyguard. he gets the song. Then we go to Croatia. I got to write another script in Croatia, finishing in Slovenia. Then we go to Austria because we'd never been for 2 or 3 days. Then he went back to LA and I'm like, well, I'm in Austria. Let's go to Paris. Let's go to Versailles. Let's go to Bordeaux. Let's go to Nice. I'm in Nice. Let's go across to Ventimiglia and then Milan. Now I'm going to go to Venice and then go to Tuscany and go to Florence and then Rome. I was going to go visit Tatiana. She said, could you wait a week? I was like, okay, well, I have a week. I'll go to Copenhagen, then go down to Cape Town. Then it's getting a little hot last summer. So I'm going to stick to Nordic countries and go to Oslo and go to Sweden. And, you know.
So you were the kid that grew up in Opa-locka,
yeah,
desperately trying to get out, at the same time scared of this idea of travel, and then something switched in you.
Something switched.
I remember when I was doing a lot of reporting for the Herald and beyond, I would always say, whenever you're scared to do something, it usually means you're going to learn something.
Absolutely.
You're about to learn something. I know that you have a reporter's background, too. You wrote at the Herald years ago, the Chicago Trib, yes. ESPN, the magazine, right? You were a sports
ESPN,
writer?
ESPN, a story about cockfighting in Mexico. A scary thing.
Tell me about that. Yeah, because that's crossing another threshold, because you're talking about gambling, another country, and gambling that's not like regulated at a sports book in Vegas. You know, you're talking about off the grid.
So these are multiple scary things on top of each other, which are multiple learning experiences. I had a year-long commission to research crypto converso Jewish families in New Mexico and the history of crypto converso Jewish heritage.
Okay, in 15 seconds, what is that?
Jewish people who escaped the Spanish Inquisition and settled in the southwest of America and who either secretly practiced Judaism knowingly, which is crypto, or people who were practicing Judaism even though they thought they were Catholic, which is converso Jews. So crypto Jews, they know they're Jewish. They pretend to be Catholic for hundreds of years and for generations while, you know, having service on the side and honoring the Sabbath in their own religion, and then pretending to be Catholic on the outside to protect themselves from, you know, being rounded up, the Spanish Inquisition. And then the converso Jews were the people who just sort of started blending in, but they still had Jewish heritage and rituals they were doing unknowingly. So
while you're studying this, you're also writing a story about cockfighting in Mexico.
So I was in New Mexico in Albuquerque.
It's no wonder that stories flow from you. Like, you're the conduit for these stories.
Well, it was something where my friend said, New Mexico is about to outlaw cockfighting. They're the 49th state. There's only one other state, Louisiana, which is not outlawed. Do you want to write a story about cockfighting? So I went around. No one would let me go into any of the secret cockfighting rings in New Mexico, because you have to know someone. So then my friend Judah said, well, I have an uncle in Mexico, in Agua Prieta, across the border, and he is a huge farmer and does cockfighting all the time. And once again, that scary feeling was in my chest, like Mexico in a border town. I was like, okay, let's do it. So she rounded up her two kids. We drove across the border, which was actually very easy. We were in Agua Prieta. We had a huge feast with six or seven of us eating. It cost us 20 pesos or $2. And then I hung out and I interviewed different cockfighters and different trainers. And I wrote the story for ESPN like several years ago about, well, I couldn't go to New Mexico, so here I am in Mexico on the border and interviewing people about what is it about cockfighting? What is the mythology that entrances you so much? And it was lovely because it's something I never would have thought of. It's something I would never do with my free time.
It's interesting to me. You've had all these experiences. You've flexed on us super hard with all the places you've been to.
There you go.
And so what keeps bringing you back to Miami and to telling, like, your latest play is telling a very small, very intimate story? What keeps you coming back here?
The things I'm uncomfortable with and the fact that I was trying to run away from Miami most of my childhood and in my early adult life. And then also Miami's changed.
Yeah.
But that thing, why am I running away from these people when ultimately I am them? The older you get, the more you become like the people you're around when you're kids. And I don't want to be one of those people that rediscovers the magic of Miami at the end of my life after traveling everywhere around the world except for my hometown.
So do you find that? Are you discovering? Tell me some things that you're discovering about Miami now as an adult versus as a kid that you really appreciate.
Well, just yesterday, we ate at Chica Miami in Little Haiti. I did not know Little Haiti was called Lemon City in the 1800s. And it was settled by Bahamians who were called Conchas back then, if you're an English-speaking Bahamian. And that there was a rivalry between Haitians and Bahamians in Lemon City.
Oh, was?
Was a rivalry. Maybe there still is. But like in the certain area where Chica Miami is, it is so beautiful and tropical and lush. You step out of the car and it feels different on your skin. And you're only a block away from Biscayne Boulevard. It just feels different in this little hamlet area.
Yeah.
And that's what made my mom notice a sign that said Lemon City. And I was like, Lemon City? I've never heard of that. That was yesterday. And then researching Lemon City, the history that goes back to the 1800s, which I think most people in Miami would not know, that there's like this history that's in the 1880s that is rich, and that the first schools in the area, Lemon High School, Lemon Elementary, were there in Little Haiti.
There's so much like part anthropologist, part history major, part therapist going on with you underneath the surface. And I feel like that probably comes out in your art, right? In your writing.
Yeah. I mean, I was my grandmother, Mima, on my dad's side, babysat me for a lot of my childhood because both of my parents worked. And we would take the bus and we'd cross over the bridge to go to Miami Beach to buy something. That was a special occasion. You take the bus and you cross the bridge to Miami Beach. I knew that my grandmother was a maid on Miami Beach. I didn't fully process what that meant, being a black maid in Miami Beach in the 50s and 60s. The fact that you needed papers, you needed a card to be on Miami Beach if you were black. And the fact that I found her card after she passed with her photo on it and her ID number that you had to take down to the police station, because otherwise the police could arrest you if you were black on Miami Beach. I can recall the sense of, we're in Miami Beach, this is great, we're doing our errands, and then the sense of, okay, come on, let's get out of here. Because Miami Beach was a sundown town. Because if you were black, when you finished work, you were supposed to leave, and sometimes your employer would make you stay late, and then you were in a panic. You're like, well, I don't want to get fired, but at the same time, if the police catch me, they will throw me in jail for the day for simply existing on Miami Beach. And so you need a ride. Sometimes your employer, if they're white, they would drive you across the bridge to safety. Sometimes you would risk it and you would win, or sometimes you'd end up in prison for a night and then have to go work the next day. You would get checked out of prison. You have to go immediately back to work. That was Miami history in the 50s and 60s. And that's the anthropology related to my family.
Right. Learning all those things, not just, you know, after her passing and such, but growing up with that, do you see how that comes out in the things that you're interested in writing? Does that affect the things that you're interested in writing?
Yeah, I always want to challenge the things that my family and friends were a little bit skittish about talking about. My grandmother did not want to talk about that. I only found that out after she passed away. All I knew, like I said, she was a maid, hotel. She kept it very surface. My other grandmother kept it very surface. But there's a lot of connections of both of my grandmothers between that and Jewish culture in Miami because of where my grandmother worked in the hotels. And then my grandmother on my mom's side with the Jewish family. And there's a lot of connection with my dad. Why did we always go to the bagel shops before elementary school and eat lox and bagels? Because his stepfather worked at a kosher factory for a while. So he would get kosher food, and growing up, he would eat all this kosher food. His bosses were kosher, and there was this connection between Black people and Jewish people in Miami because Miami Beach also was discriminatory at a certain time against Jewish people and Black people equally. And so there was this bond of let's help each other out.
There's this element to these heroes in your life. We would call them that yes. Now, but they were really, that's what they are, folks who show you the world and keep you safe in a way.
Don't tell you the full truth because they're processing it as well, and they don't want it to spoil your trip to Miami Beach.
And it's not till you're an adult yourself and you start looking back on it in a different way, I imagine, that you start to make sense of those things.
Yes.
I want to take a little bit of a break, and then I want to come back with that idea of not... that turns into you not pulling punches when you tell a story, and we see that in your upcoming play. But I want to take a little break. We're talking with Oren Squire. His new play is Defacing Michael Jackson, playing at the Colony Theater in Miami Beach. We'll be back with Oren in just a minute on Sundial. We're back on Sundial. This is Carlos Frias, and our guest today is Oren Squire. His new play is Defacing Michael Jackson, and you've certainly seen his work on TV, on the show This Is Us, and CBS's Evil. So we can't stop talking even during the break. And during the break, you mentioned that that you were a kid growing up with a real particular sense of humor.
Yeah, my dad, my sister, my mom loved Woody Allen, loved old school Jewish comedians and old school Black comedians. And I guess I took that on. And when I went to Northwestern undergrad and I was in classes, I got asked this more than once. Jewish people would come up to me and say, "Are you Jewish?"
Because somebody would park and you'd say, "That's okay, I'll walk the rest of the way."
Exactly. Or that sort of like sarcastic, "It's okay. You know, I wanted to stand. I didn't need my chair."
Did that set you apart, or did that? I don't know. How did that affect?
They just wanted to know what the connection point was, because I guess I had a sensibility they were familiar with. And I didn't process it. That was just my dad and my mom. And then my grandparents working and living around Jewish people and eating Jewish food. So you grow up eating that. And then at a certain point, someone makes you aware of that by asking, "Are you actually Jewish?" And I go, "No, I'm not." But I guess there's that sensibility. There's an intertwining mix of Black and Jewish culture in Miami. In the 50s and 60s, and it comes out in the people who lived in this area. And then another person asked me, "Are you Jewish? Are you sure you're not Jewish? Are you sure there's no?" And then I got invited to those high school trips where they take kids to Israel, and I was invited a few times to that. I was very tempted on going, but my parents wouldn't let me. And I was like, "Let's go to Israel. They say I'm part Jewish anyway." So,
then we watched Annie
Hall. I would definitely go back and go to Israel.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about your play in specific, because I know your TV work is the TV work. You know, you're a writer in the room, but this is your baby. So Defacing Michael Jackson, the moments, the real shock, the strong moments were the points where the characters really want to hurt each other.
Yes.
And they use the most aggressive and offensive words relating to race and even colorism.
Colorism was huge.
Tell me about number one, not just noticing that, right? But then deciding this, I'm going to lean into this and put this in this play.
I was a very shy kid. I would try to just blend in, be happy with people. But I rode the bus to school every day, and we rode the jitney since we technically weren't supposed to go to Aventura. So we rode, it took 2 hours to get to school. And you're talking about kids in the back of the bus before iPhones, and before cell phones at all, and all we have of each other, and it would just be a dozens contest. So dozens of the Dirty Dozens, the Black communities, when you go back and forth with your mama so this, your mama so that, you so poor, you so that. And it's meant jokingly, but it's based upon observations you've made about that person. So if someone comes in wearing Bobos, which are like non-official shoes.
What are those?
Like, exactly. What are those? You went to Payless shoe store and you got something off the clearance rack. You would clock that and then you'd save it for later on. Like, okay, I'm going to talk about your shoes. At the right time, I'm going to crack on you about your shoes, about your hair. If your hair isn't, you know, straight enough, or if it's too kinky, I'm going to talk about your skin tone. If it's not the preferred skin tone of the Black community back then and now too, I'm going to wait. And so we'd have these dozens contests where you just crack it on people, your mom, but really it was mostly about you. And whatever I could find just to protect myself, I would have to come up with a file of note observations about people that I could use to attack them.
Let me tell you, that self-defense, I rode the jitney bus too, like, you know, the little 12-passenger buses. People didn't know, like kids today don't know that you rode on a bus, they could probably roll over and kill everybody inside. But that was the school bus, you know, mine was blue and white. And there is that sense of when you get on the bus, a little bit of self-defense coming up, like, what is going to happen today?
There's a bunch of stand-up comedians, wannabe stand-up comedians on the jitney, and they're just waiting to do crowd work. They're waiting to do the crowd work. You have to be ready.
And if you shrink, you're
then
toast.
They got you.
Yeah.
And I remember I was in middle school, and there was a kid, I'm not going to say his name, but he was picking on me, and I didn't think the jokes were that witty or funny, but it was getting attention. And so I thought, I have to do something about this. He would say stuff like four eyes. I'm like, four eyes? What are the 1960s? But it got attention. So I was like, okay, you have my attention now. And so I went home and then I started writing out insults. I was like, tomorrow I need to be prepared.
This was your set.
Yeah, I need my set. I need my crowd work set. Here are all the things about this guy. Haircut, looks, name. I was like, oh, his name is
Keep it NPR, but give
exactly.
us some. Give us some.
Well, it's Ida Blank is all I'm going to say. And it's Ida Blank and his haircut. And I crafted the jokes, the punchline, the twist. And then I practice them in front of the mirror and you sort of edit and you go, okay, now I'm going to try this material out tomorrow. And sure enough, he came after me because I'm an easy target. And you wait until people get silent and then you just have to have the timing, the precision, and the levity in your voice, like, oh, I'm just coming up with this off the fly. This is just an observation I have about your name, about your haircut, about the way you look, about the way you smell. I'm going to get in there, inside of your soul. And he was shocked. And everyone burst out laughing. And that was the end of it. And I knew I had to do this a few more times and he would stop. Because you don't just hit a dog once. They're going to do it a few more times and then before they obey. So he did it like two more times, he would attack me and I would immediately come back just as strong and then he stopped.
But what
and that was a miracle.
Wow.
I went around to other people who were picking on me and I became very good, maybe this is why I'm a writer, of just like finding the most hurtful thing to say to end the war immediately. I'm not trying to do a back and forth dance. I'm trying to get in with three short jabs that are intent to rip your heart out. And if it's a Black person, if it's color, skin tone, I'm going to talk about that. If it's hair, even though I don't care, I know that's what they're sensitive about. There was someone in middle school who was, according to Eurocentric standards, white girl, probably the prettiest person I've ever seen in my life. Unbelievable. Blonde, blue eyes, the whole thing, golden brown skin. And we got into it one day and I was like, all right, well, what do I got in this person? This is hard.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
And so I was like, the weakness of most people who are like that is they don't think they're beautiful.
Ooh.
Even though to me, this person is beautiful, they don't think they're beautiful. So I went in as an experiment. I'm going to talk about how you look, how ugly you are. I was like, I did a few jabs. This is a white girl who's not used to playing the dozens. She was shocked. Because she doesn't ride the jitney. She goes home in the Mercedes with her kid, with her parents.
With her parents, right.
And she was like,
and Clarence's
shocked.
Parents got some real lessons.
And I just dug into how ugly. You think you're good looking? You're so ugly. And I did this a few times. And she just was like, shut up. That was her response to the dozens. And she completely shut down. She started to tear up. And then I stopped because I don't want to make a white girl cry. That's a black person doesn't want to make a white girl cry. But I did enough that she knew, like, don't ever mess with me again. And I know your weak spot. Even though everyone else thinks you're gorgeous, you think you're ugly. And that's the trick psychologically. It's not what actually appears. It's what people's insecurities are. Even if they're muscular, they're muscular because they always were scared of being weak. If they're overly muscular and they're overcompensating. So I'm going to attack how weak you are, your manhood. If I see a muscle bound guy, I'm going to go in because I know that's armor that you created. And it works 99% of the time. You look at the thing they have. If they have highlights in the hair, talk about their hair because they're sensitive about that.
All right, give me one.
No, I wouldn't.
Come on. Come on.
No.
Come on, you gotta.
I mean,
get me.
I
you
have
gotta a, get. Look, I'm giving you a free
no,
shot.
No, I. This is. I'll do it off
air.
Off air.
So you can use the four letter words. That's
exactly.
All right. I'm okay with that.
I mean, but and I love, if you're light skinned Latino, there's stuff you could be about white, but male. You know, you're not a real Latino. You're white bread and blah blah blah. So and so. You just go off until you find what they're insecure about, and you're like fishing. You're fishing for that flash of recognition they have when you've hit their point. And so you just do this, you know, exploratory mission of insults until you feel them wince a little bit. And then you go in for that chink in the armor.
And that's so much like understanding people, like to have that right away. And I know that you use that in your play. Like I was watching when I got to see your play on Sunday, I recognized that there were moments where these kids are seeing that in each other. They're seeing the weakness in each other. They're being protective and they're it's the opposite to a physical punch, right?
It's worse than the physical punch.
Oh yeah,
I've gotten into physical fights when I was, you know, a child. That's easy, especially with guys or boys. Most of the time, the physical fight ends, and if it's okay, you're usually fine in a day or two, seeing each other. But a insult fight, if it goes too deep, if the dozens go too deep, and then it clearly switches over into I'm angry at you, it can go all sorts of places. I was on the jitney one time, and I was going in on someone because they're picking on me. And he said, I'm going to tell my brother and he's going to come back and shoot you. Now, this is the 80s.
You've gone too far.
So this is, yeah, I went too far.
Yeah.
This is before mass shootings became a daily occurrence like we're seeing today.
Sure.
But in my mind, I processed, what are the odds that that actually is going to happen because of my words? That this guy's going to tell his brother he's going to come. And I played it. And you have to play it off like, oh, that ain't nothing. I ain't scared of your brother, blah, blah, blah. But in my mind, the next day, I'm thinking, am I going to get shot for literally just insulting him and trying to protect myself? And he sort of hinted at it again, and then he dropped it. But that was just through words. If we actually fought, we would have just hit each other a few times, and it would have stopped.
So we only have a couple minutes left. But I want to talk about, just real quickly, in the last minute and a half or so, really how that idea... Why you chose Michael Jackson then as an overriding figure as you tell those stories of kids finding themselves and figuring themselves out?
He was a beacon, and then he shifted. And in that shift to becoming more, let's say, white, skinnier nose, paler skin, longer hair, there was a hurt in the black community. And I could feel it when, you know, Ebony, Jet on the radio waves here. There was a hurt that then converted into the dozens. It converted into, let's insult him now. Looking like a white woman, blah, blah, blah. And just going in, and there was a period where he was raised up, and then there was a period where we started to bury him under ridicule and scorn and the nastiest things we could think about. And then when he got accused of all these crimes and it appeared like his white benefactors had turned against him, then they're usually welcomed back into the black community. Once they're like, oh, now you're black again. OJ, Michael Jackson, now you're black again because the white people don't want you anymore, then we almost stick up for them. We forget about all the insults and we remember that they were a part of our family. And I think that's why Michael Jackson represents that twist and that transition in my life and in pop culture.
And folks can see the different ways in that plays out in Oren's new play. We've been speaking with Oren Squire. His new play is Defacing Michael Jackson. It's playing at the Colony Theater in Miami Beach through April 2nd. Oren, thank you so much for coming in and sharing so much of yourself.
Thank you for having me.
And that's Sundial for March 27th. Leslie Obaye Atkinson is our lead producer. Elisa Baena is our producer and social media editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's VP of News. Katie Munoz is our director of live programming. And Peter J. Mertz is WLRN's vice president of radio and Sundial's engineer. Our theme music is by the Afro-Cuban funk band Palo at gopalo.com. If you missed any part of this, you can download the podcast. Just search for WLRN Sundial on your podcast app. Coming up tomorrow, the award-winning writer and poet Hanif Abdurahib. He'll be in town for O Miami's opening night for Poetry Month. Before that, he joins us. I'm Carlos Frias. Thanks for listening.
WLRN Public Media.